This is episode 4 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Welcome, everybody, to episode 4 of the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Bradley Kuhn with a giggling Karen Sandler.
And I'm Karen Sandler. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, indeed. See, this is why it's a joyous, happy occasion, the beginning of 2009.
Absolutely.
Here we are with our first podcast for the new year.
With a great guest.
With a great guest, indeed. You know, we've been talking to all these different guests about lots of policy issues and, you know, the various things they've done in the free software world. And one of the things I really like to do is find out about their history and how they got involved in free software and what interests them. And I think I've, in some of the early interviews, forgotten that, you know, I've known these people for a really long time and basically know their history. But I want our listeners to be able to get a sense of, you know, how they got into it, what their past is like, you know, what drew them to free software.
And this guest in particular, in part because we worked with him for a number of years.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, SFLC's now been around long enough that we have basically people who have come through, spent some great time working with us, doing some interesting things for SFLC's clients, and then have gone out into the larger free software space, and in this case with Red Hat, which is a company well known in the free software area, doing lots of development stuff, mostly through the Fedora project, as well as other contributions that they've made. So it's going to be really interesting to hear, you know, how Fontana ended up, you know, coming
through
here.
I think we actually did not say his name yet in this episode. Yeah. So our guest today is Richard Fontana.
Yeah, and we call him by his last name. And the reason that started, actually, was he worked here at SFLC on the GPLv3 process with Richard Stallman and Eben Moglen and many of us who were involved. And, of course, there was this immediate problem that both Richard Stallman and Richard Fontana, his first name is Richard, so we started calling him by his last name, and fortunately it was very easy for the other Richard, because for years he's been called RMS rather than just Richard. So we had RMS and Fontana, so we all are very used to calling
it's
him
true.
By his last
and I've
name.
And I actually had situations where I have had to introduce him publicly and inadvertently referred to him as only Fontana.
Well, and indeed his username here was Fontana as well, which and there's a long history of calling free software people by their username. I mean, why not? Which is exactly why you insisted I make your username Karen instead of
Absolutely.
Your last name. Otherwise, we'd all call you by your last name, which you don't want.
Nope.
So without further discussion then, why don't we move on to our excellent interview with Richard Fontana.
Great. Welcome back. With us, Bradley and me today, we are lucky to have Richard Fontana, who is the Open Source Licensing and Patent Counsel at Red Hat. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Bradley.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess maybe to get things started, one of the things that's been a little bit of a running theme for us in these podcasts is to ask people who are involved in the free and open source software community how they became involved, especially lawyers. So how did you wind up? I know you have a technical background. Is it a computer science background?
Yes, I do have a computer science background. I have a master's degree in computer science. I spent some amount of time studying computer science. That's not directly how I got involved in free software and open source software law, but it is part of the reason I got there ultimately, I suppose. But it's kind of an odd story because I got a master's degree in computer science after getting a law degree and after practicing law in a very big New York law firm for a few years. So that isn't usually how it's done, although I know other lawyers who have done things like that.
So what led you to go back, Richard, after you were practicing for a while? What led you to want to go back and get another computer science degree?
Oh, well, I really, after practicing law for a few years in a big sort of impersonal New York law firm, I was, you know, I guess I was sort of burned out, I like a lot of my coworkers were. A lot of associates in law firms like that really just don't stick with it. They move on to smaller firms. They move on to corporations or government positions, or they move outside of law completely. And I really was tired of practicing law at the time, and I was kind of disenchanted with it. I started out, after I got out of law school, I never intended to work at a big law firm, but I kind of wound up there just like a lot of other law students do. It's just sort of the path of least resistance. And I actually liked it for a while and found it very rewarding. But after a number of years, I just wanted to do something very different. And so I sort of woke up one day and decided, hey, I should become a computer scientist. And it's kind of as crazy as that. I very much wanted to kind of do something with my mind and something that was very intellectual but also very different from legal work, and to kind of get as far from legal work as possible at that time. So that I think that's how I would explain it.
Academic computer science is one of the furthest from practice of law, I think, that you could get. So it sounds like you went the right path if that was the goal.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. It is, although I found that academic computer science departments are not altogether different from law firms in their political structure. I say that in a kind of negative way. So it wasn't altogether different.
Is that how you wound up back in the practice of law?
well, yeah. I mean, I was. There's no way to describe this story without sounding kind of like a total flake. But I spent a long time trying to figure out what I, wanted to do when I finally grew up, and I don't think I really got to know that until I came to SFLC, which I haven't gotten to yet, but. So I was actually in a PhD program for computer science and had it in my head that I wanted to be a researcher or a professor. But after doing that for a while, I realized that that wasn't quite for me either. And there were things about the legal profession that I missed. So I found my way back to practicing law. The first stage of my legal career, I had focused on litigation and increasingly on patent and trademark litigation. So I was part of what was called an intellectual property practice group in my original law firm. And I actually started out doing other kinds of litigation. I did securities litigation and antitrust litigation, but I kind of did more and more patent litigation. So having spent some time acquiring a lot of knowledge and credentials in computer science, I thought, well, I could be marketable and find my way back into the legal profession by combining my technical degree with doing legal work. And so I naturally gravitated towards doing intellectual property work oriented towards software. And so I got a job at an intellectual property law firm. So there are some relatively small law firms that focus on patent, copyright, and trademark law, and they're called IP law firms or IP boutiques. And I guess we should point out that the term intellectual property is one that has been criticized by some prominent people in the free software movement, most notably Richard Stallman. Well, by the way, though, Richard Stallman back in the 80s used the phrase intellectual property, I have found. So it was only much later on that he realized that it was a problematic term, and I actually agree with him about that. But it is an umbrella term that is used by lawyers, and it has some convenience to it. It does describe, there certainly are law firms that focus on those particular areas of law and have found a certain kind of synergy in those combining those practice areas. So I found my way back to practicing law again, and this time in IP firms. So I focused on software patent prosecution and patent litigation. And I did that for a while. And that was, I would say, a kind of a bad experience in a lot of ways. And it, I think that had a lot to do with leading me to SFLC, which led me to, the kind of career I have today. So I sorry.
Yeah, I was just gonna point out for our listeners, because you know we're interviewing you now that you're at your position at Red Hat, but many of our listeners may not realize that you in fact did work with us here with me and Karen at SFLC for quite a while in between this time you're talking about and the time at Red Hat.
Yeah, it's kind of I hope I'm not taking too much time to kind of explain the story, but
oh, not at all. I just want to make sure everyone understands, you know, that that used to be one of our colleagues here at SFLC. Some people might not know that.
Which I think makes it particularly fun to interview you.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's very fun to talk to you guys too. So just to kind of finish up this part of the story, I got exposed to the software patent system almost from the inside, you might say. I took the patent bar exam. I was qualified to write patent applications, and these kinds of law firms really they valued my background because I had, you know, I had a computer science degree, I had patent experience. So you know, to them, I was very much a kind of valuable person. But I just found this kind of work, frankly, really distasteful. I could go into that in more detail if you want, but once again, I had kind of practiced law, but found myself rather disenchanted with the kind of work I was doing, and yet I really did feel that being a lawyer was the right thing for me to do. Strangely enough, that I just didn't feel that I was in the right, you know, area to focus on. What happened? I sort of accepted the fact that I was stuck in a career that I didn't like, but it seemed like the only thing I really knew how to do. So I thought that, you know, at this time I spent some time in Chicago, and then I moved to Seattle, and I thought, well, I need to get back to my hometown, which was New York. At least I will be happy being home, because I had been away from home for a long time. By the way, I'm not living in New York now, but we can get to that later. the law firm I worked at before coming to SFLC let me transfer to their New York office, and I got back to New York, but I was still very much dissatisfied with the work I was doing, and I just couldn't see myself doing it for much longer. And then I saw a job ad for the Software Freedom Law Center. They were looking for someone with patent experience and copyright and trademark experience, and someone who knew about free software and open source software. And I guess I should mention that I had spent years as a user of free software and GNU/Linux. It's sort of impossible to be a computer science graduate student, at least in the 90s and 2000s, it was impossible without being a user of that kind of software. And so I had been I had certainly been on the edges of the free software world, and I had observed it closely. I don't know if I'd really thought much about the legal issues prior to the SCO case, which I think kind of awakened an interest in free software licensing issues that I previously just hadn't had. But anyway, so I saw this amazing job ad for SFLC, and it seemed like something I qualified for, it was in the nonprofit sector, and I remember my sister told me, maybe I should just work in the nonprofit sector. She had done that, and so everything about it seemed great. And so I contacted SFLC and had a series of interviews, and I was hired, and I was actually hired primarily to work with Eben Moglen on the GPL version 3 drafting process, which was just getting started in its formal phase at that time, and this was in late 2005. So that's how I got to SFLC, and I think that's the long answer for how I got into free software / open source software licensing law. I got a job at SFLC, and I had to, learn a lot, and I really did not know very much at first, but I really feel like I just learned a lot very quickly, and it just completely fascinated me, and really for the first time in my adult, you know, post-college life, I felt like I was doing work that was fulfilling and meaningful to me and thoroughly interesting. So my career finally took a step for the, you know, a direction for the better. And that is, so I'm at Red Hat now, but I was at SFLC until early this year, 2008.
But I have a question for you. But one thing, since now I have the opportunity, you mentioned being interviewed, I can apologize publicly for grilling you so much on the interview, which you and I have talked a lot about, that I'm quite a grilling interviewer when you were going through the process. So
yes,
I apologize for grilling you so much now to the public of our podcast listeners.
Well, yes, now you've never actually said whether you recommended that I not be hired, but I don't know. I don't know, and I've never really wanted to know the answer to that, But you know, I think
I think it's wonderful that you came to work here, Richard. I think it's one of the best things
like
that ever happened.
Dancing
to
around that, to answer that question.
Oh, come on!
But I think everybody here is so glad when you came to work for.
But
for
there's
SMLC.
One thing you mentioned, Richard, that I think is going to be really interesting to our listeners. You talked about the challenge of sort of getting up to speed when you first came in to actually think about licensing issues and issues of law around free software. What are the things that you wish you'd known coming in that you learned on the job as you were doing GPLv3 that you'd wish you'd known to start with? So maybe our listeners can learn from you on that.
Well, you know, it's, I would actually say that it, I just said that I kind of spent a while getting up to speed on free software legal issues, but in fact, it really was an ongoing process. And I do remember, you know, I'd been working at SFLC for a few months, and I remember reaching some sort of epiphany. But I think it was really just kind of the very beginning, and I've it's been a continuing learning process. What I would say, you know, one insight that I have come to over time is that the law of free software is there's, if you know your legal history, there's something called the lex mercatoria or the law merchant, which is, you know, if you go back to the Middle Ages, there was sort of legal system, an international legal system, which grew out of just the customary relationships between merchant traders. They developed certain practices, certain informal legal rules that governed their relationships with one another. And so it's a kind of law that was not written down. It was totally customary. It grew out of tradition, a little bit like common law, but even more informal. And I think that free software law is very much like that. I mean, we often lose sight of that because we focus on these licenses, which are written down. But the texts of these licenses really only are the tip of the iceberg for understanding the free software legal system. And I think it really is a legal system that has been constructed on top of a very inadequate statutory and, you know, common law and, you know, judge-made law system of intellectual property law, you know, copyright law and patent law and so forth.
Do you mean like a system of customs and practices?
Yeah, it's a system of customary law. It's this is, I think, something that a lot of lawyers who approach, you know, what they typically call open source, don't quite get that this is the meaning of these licenses and the set of practices and expectations that have been grown up around these licenses is something that grows out of a tradition, out of a community tradition. And there are, you know, debates within that larger community and factions and struggles. It is problematic that in a certain sense, even though the materials for communication among the participants in this community are you know, involve the written word, email and news groups and mailing lists and IRC and so forth, a lot of this material is just not written down, so it's not accessible to people who are kind of on the outside trying to study it. So I think that is something that I had to gradually grasp. I think I kind of knew it on some level, because I had, as I said, sort of participated on the edge of the free software world as a, you know, as a computer science student and as a GNU/Linux user. But that is the most important realization I have ever come to, that this is really all about tradition and custom and building a new legal system, a kind of law reform effort out of tradition and on top of the real failure of traditional software licensing law.
Well, one of the goals of V3 was to try and incorporate some of the knowledge that had been built up in this way you're talking about V2 into the actual document. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your experience as part of the GPL V3 drafting team and creating a license that better embodied both the text of the older version of V2 as well as the practices that have become standard, you know, in the post V2 era.
Right. I spent a year and a half of my life focusing primarily on GPL version 3, and you know, Richard Stallman and Evan Moglen and I were a kind of three-person team. I mean, in a sense, Richard Stallman was making all the policy decisions, but we were advising him and assisting him with the drafting, and at the same time, we were conducting this public or quasi-public negotiation with various, I hate to use this word, but stakeholders in the you know, free software and open source world. We had these discussion committees, and we held meetings, and there were behind the scenes discussions with many of them as well. And there was a kind of lobbying effort by many companies who felt they had to they had some stake in the outcome. And so it was just a very rich process. You know, as a lawyer, you know, it involved both counseling a client and also negotiating for the client with other parties in other interest groups, in public. So there was a public and a private aspect of that. But anyway, as you say, the one of the primary goals of GPL V3 was to codify the interpretations of GPL V2 that had developed over the years. So it in a sense, GPL V3 is a reflection of that kind of evolving tradition that I've talked about, although specific to the GPL. So I think you can't really understand GPL 3 without just by looking at the text. You really have to understand the tradition of interpretation of the GPL, both by the FSF and by other, you know, users and licensors and licensees of GPL software from, you know, the late 1980s to 2006.
Yeah, one of the things that was a big part of codifying things in V3 and making things clear was the issue of the patent license, and which is a really big issue, I think, for free software developers, most of whom are opposed to software patents in general. And I actually was somewhat amazed when, before this interview, we asked you what your official title was, and I noticed it includes patent counsel. So what does it mean to be a patent counsel for an organization that's operating in the open source and free software space that is primarily opposed to the idea of software patents altogether?
I think that, first of all, you know, when I was at SFLC, to some degree, I think I was I filled the role just as Dan Ravisher did, of being a patent attorney for free software developers. So there is anyone involved in creating free software or distributing it or modifying it has to be concerned about the problem of software patents. So I think any organization that is involved in the using free software needs patent counsel in a defensive sense. Now, Red Hat has had a pretty consistent position on software patent. It is said that, you know, we'd all be better off if software patents did not exist. And Red Hat has, you know, some of the things I've done since coming to Red Hat involve, you know, for example, submitting a friend of the court brief in the Bilski case in the Federal Circuit with my colleague Rob Tiller. And the Federal Circuit recently handed down that decision in a way that we are cautiously optimistic about. But so Red Hat is pretty active in what I call law reform efforts that are reflect its real hostility to software patents. Red Hat also has a defensive patent portfolio program. The view is that you know, living in the real world, Red Hat needs to build up a patent portfolio just to defend itself from potential threats from hostile proprietary software companies. And now at Red Hat, I have not been deeply involved in the efforts to expand the patent portfolio. That's primarily done by my coworker, Adam Avrunin. But I've helped out a little bit with that. But you know, I think the bulk of my work really is more on the open source licensing side, although patent issues always come up there as well. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
I think we'll probably ask you more about that too, but I guess just to back up a little bit, you mentioned writing an amicus brief for Bilski, and while we have you here, there's been a lot of, I guess, different analysis about what the impact of Bilski is likely to be, and it would be great to hear what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly the ascendancy of business method patents is over, and that is a good thing. But what is the impact for software patents? I'm not sure yet. My colleague Rob Tiller is pretty optimistic about this, and he's written some articles recently about that. My experience as a patent attorney, you know, my pre-SFLC experience, makes me somewhat pessimistic and doubtful. Because I have generally found that patent attorneys who are, you know, drafting patent claims, at least the clever ones, are able to find ways of drafting around these decisions. You know, they will find a way, or so I fear, they will find a way to get the same kinds of software patent claims issued, just maybe in somewhat different form. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. There has been a change in the direction of the courts. There's no question about that. With respect to both the Supreme Court, there was the KSR decision a couple of years ago, which clarified the test for obviousness, and there have been other decisions in the courts and also in the PTO itself that suggest that we really are moving away from an era that lasted for a few decades of really expanding the power of patent holders. So we are moving back in the other direction. Now, I don't know if Bilski is going to be applied to software patents in a way that will seriously limit their patentability, but I think it could serve as a step in that direction. I think there may be future court decisions that will take some of the principles in Bilski a few steps further, and then we may see some real reform. So I am somewhat pessimistic, but at the same time, I think there's a part of me that is guardedly optimistic about the future.
Yeah, now, Karen, you've made this our question we have to ask everybody now that we ask Scott and now Richard. Now, we'll always have to ask it anytime there's a patent attorney on their
well,
opinion of Bilski.
Well, it's still pretty fresh. I think we're still seeing some sensationalist reporting about it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, I think for good reason, too. But but at the same time, it's really good to get different viewpoints. So thanks for sharing that.
So to wrap up, Richard, since this is our first show of 2009, I want to ask if you have any New Year resolutions related to free software, and if there's a New Year's resolution you wish free software developers would take.
Sure. Well, resolutions related to free software. So one thing I really want to do is to, and I've wanted to do this for some time, I want to get involved in free software somehow, not simply as a lawyer. I've thought about getting involved in the Fedora project, which is Red Hat's sponsored community GNU/Linux distribution project. I thought about getting involved in that project in some kind of significant non-legal way. I have not done anything yet in that direction, but that is something that I've been thinking more and more about lately. So, and maybe other things as well. So I think that I really think that I want to be more of a participant and not merely as a lawyer in the free software world. So I have some time to figure out what form that will take. Now, as for free software developers, I'm not sure. You know what I'd like to see? This sort of builds upon what I was talking about with respect to free software law growing out of custom and tradition. I'd like to see more of an effort to collect those traditions and to express or consolidate some of the principles that come out of those traditions, if that makes sense. Maybe that's something that SFLC can help out with. Maybe that's something that I can help out with. Maybe that's something that free software developers can figure out a way to help out with. But I don't know if I've really made the case yet for the importance of that, but I do see the need for, this is kind of like a common law system without any, volumes of case reports. So there is a kind of problem of inaccessibility of source material, if we think of this as a system of customary law. And I've given some thought to, how can we start to, just as GPL3 codified the interpretation history of GPL2, how can we do that more generally for the world of free software licensing? So that may sound a bit kind of abstract or vague, but somehow I think that's a resolution in it.
It's certainly a good idea. I think it's certainly a project for more than 1 year, so it could be your resolution for 2010 too, I think. But Richard, I want to thank you for spending the time telling us your story. I it's been wonderful. I even learned a few things about you I didn't know already, mm-hmm. which is somewhat hard to do because we've known each other for a while. And I think it's just great, and I hope our listeners enjoy, and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you both very much. It's been great talking to you.
Hi, Richard.
Bye.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.